Hi, everyone. Just a reminder that this show is not legal advice, trading advice, financial advice, or personal advice. Enjoy the show, and thank you very much. This show is sponsored by the MIT Sloan School of Management's Blockchain Technologies online program, delivered in collaboration with Get Smarter. Yo, yo, welcome to Crypto 101, the average consumer's guide to cryptocurrency. This is Matthew Aaron. Today, we have on Rong Chen, CEO and founder of Elastos. And this is a very ambitious and detailed project. So I'm not going to waste too much time talking about it myself. I'm going to let Rong talk about it himself. Before we get into that, though, please go to crypto101podcast.com. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram is all available for you there. Please think about becoming a patron. Also, go to iTunes, CastBox, SoundCloud, Pocket Cast, or anywhere you listen to your podcast. Subscribe, leave a comment, and a rating. It is very much appreciated. And don't forget that ICO 101 with Aaron Paul is popping up in the feeds. Check him out when you see the orange icon. And lastly, check out our YouTube channel, Crypto 101 with Matthew Aaron, where we give you previews and roundups to all of our episodes that we put out. Without further ado, here is Mr. Rong Chen of Elastos. We'll see you after the show. Mr. Rong Chen, founder of Elastos, welcome to Crypto 101, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking time out of your day. You're flying out tomorrow and you're putting an hour for Crypto 101. We really appreciate that. What we want to do today is we want to get to know about you, sir. You're one of the most talked about new projects in the space right now. We want to know about your history, how you started Elastos, what was the inspiration? Of course, a 101 on the project. It is a very in-depth project. It's been your brainchild, as you just told me offline, since the year 2000. So it's been a lot of years in the making, a lot of years kicking around in your brain. And then I just want your opinion on blockchain in the crypto space. Is that okay, sir?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Excellent. So, sir, tell us a little bit about your history and your story.
Well, it's a long story.
Well, not too long.
My name is Rong Chen. Actually, I was born and raised in China. I went to the United States in year 1984, January, so which is more than 34 years ago. I was one of the first batch of exchange students from China, mainland China,
wow,
to go to the United States for graduate studies. So when I first landed in the USA, remember that was 1984, three things happened. 84, 85, the internet was called ARPANET, and it changed its name to internet. I remember when I was at University of Illinois, we were told we shouldn't call it ARPANET anymore, we should call it internet. So I started to learn TCP/IP at that time. And another thing happened, Unix was open sourced to universities like University of Illinois, Berkeley, and CMU, first class computer science schools. But that's sad because at that time, people were thinking it's a modern operating system. Everyone was very excited. Multi-processing and parallel computing started at that time. So it's another drive to push the computer frontier. The third thing happened during those times. I was in Bell Labs. There was a C with class, a new compiler for translate C++ into C programming language. So I started to learn C++ in 86, so which is also very early to study object-oriented programming. So by that time, we were thinking to put three things together in one. University of Illinois invented the first so-called operating system written in C++ called Choices. I learned a little bit about that. That's when everything got started. After that, of course, I wanted to design my own operating system, which failed after 7 years, long years, because at that time, actually, people could single-handedly, one or two people can write an operating system at that time. And so many operating systems and compilers, operating systems, internet protocols came out around the same period of time. But I tried, I failed. Nevertheless, I learned something, so I ended up going to Microsoft and Microsoft Research doing kernels. And that's another 8 long years in Microsoft to do kernels and object-oriented programming and network. To be specific, at Microsoft, I did the operating system kernel at Microsoft Research. and I joined Microsoft browser team as the 10th member of IE team to study and to learn to implement browsers. And also, of course, at that time, we did ActiveX. And later on, I was doing so-called Olay and COM, a component object model. Basically, still around that three things I just mentioned. In winter of 1998 and spring of 1999, I was in a group called .NET. I was there when it just started the project. So we tried to design a network OS called .NET. We also come up with the programming paradigm called SaaS, Software as a Service. So that was that long ago. And of course, since I did some kernel before, there's two schools of thoughts to do .NET. One is using C#, the intermediate language, competing with Java. And the other one is coming from kernel background, we do it, do everything in C, in native language. So but Microsoft decided to adopt the C# paradigm. So I quit. I started Elastos in year 2000. The dream was to design a network OS in C++. Mm-hmm. That was still a long story short.
All right. So where were you born in China?
I was born in Beijing long time ago.
Okay. I'm just asking because I lived in China for 13 years. Six years, the listeners know, but I lived 6 years in Beijing and 7 years in Shanghai. And I studied Chinese at Beijing University, and I used to live in the Wudaokou area, or Sisanhua.
We're neighbors. I graduated from Tsinghua University.
Oh, okay.
We'll always tease each other.
what people don't know is China calls Tsinghua University the MIT of China. It is arguably the best university in China in competition with Beijing University.
Yeah, because when people talk in Chinese, Beijing University always go first. Of course, it's a rivalry, and it's a fun.
It is definitely a rivalry. Well, I want to get into Elastos in a little bit, but you said, because this is very interesting, the history aspect of this. China opened up in, was it 76 or 79?
78.
I'm sorry. 78. So 78, and then you said you were part of the first batches of Chinese exchange students over to the U.S. What was that like, coming over from China to the United States in 84?
Before then, actually, I worked on a farm during the Cultural Revolution, and all of a sudden, university resumed. So I was even lucky enough, actually, I was still a laborer at that time in the village, took the national exam, and got accepted to Tsinghua University. So I was really lucky. I remember when we were taking a calculus class one day in 1979, and because, you know, classrooms are very quiet, but then a radio was turned on really loud, mm-hmm. Which, you know, people kind of surprised and turn around their heads. And the radio was reporting that China is setting up diplomatic relations with the United States. And then there was a loud round of applause. During the class. So that was really something. And of course, 1 year later, in 1980, China started to have grad students, exchange graduate students to the United States. Very few, because of the first class of the undergrad won't graduate until 82. So I was that first class ever graduated and earned my scholarship to study in the U.S.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. That's an amazing story because I really don't know if people can grasp the history of China. You are a China pioneer for the most part. To go to the States to get education there.
Very lucky for you. Because at that time, except there are a few that their family could sponsor themselves because it was a so-called socialist system. Actually, no one can afford to study in the U.S. Mm-hmm. The country was just so poor. So the only way out without family or sponsorships, it's through government. So I was actually sponsored by the Chinese government at that time.
Wow.
As an exchange student. That said, actually, the quota is about, what, about 500-ish a year mm-hmm. at that time. So I was, I guess, lucky enough.
Right on.
Consider, you know, a country more than a billion, right?
Right. No.
There are only like 500
out of a billion
exchange students ever, you know, that year. I came to the U.S.
And just another question about this. And how was the you took the, was it at that time testing into Tsinghua? Was it the Gaokao at that time as well?
That was the first Gaokao, the first national exam after the Cultural Revolution, because the university stopped during the Cultural Revolution for 10 years, and so basically another thing is turned me into maybe the most senior class of software engineers in China, because of before then there was no computer science departments. And after the Cultural Revolution, there's a computer science department, and I was the first class.
How did you keep up with your studies if you were a laborer on a farm in a village to get such a high mark in the Gaokao and then get into the best universities in China? And how did you maintain that study to and that drive?
First of all, I guess that lucky enough. But secondly, when I was in middle school, high school, at that time, even though it's during the Cultural Revolution, you know, people don't really study much, because I was one of the few really put my heart into studies, because has something to do with you. If you've been into China, right, there's those nationalists who lost the Civil War. And turned out my grandfather was on the wrong side.
I'm living in Taiwan right now, so.
Yeah. those are the unlucky guys. And my grandparents even was not lucky enough to even go to Taiwan. They ended up in Hong Kong. They escaped from China and could not go to Taiwan. So that's even more unfortunate. But that said, my family have to manage to survive. And one way to survive actually is to excel, because there's no other way for me. So I ended up, I studied, and that was okay.
Wow, man, that's an amazing story. Thank you for sharing that. I can talk to you about this all day, because it's very, very rare that I get to hear somebody with a story and background of you, but people aren't turning to Crypto 101 to hear about Chinese history, because it's just amazing. Your story is amazing, to go from the Cultural Revolution to Tsinghua to one of 500 people getting a scholarship from the government out of billions, you know, going to the United States to working at Microsoft and then starting this company, Elastos. Could you please tell us just a little bit about how did the idea of Elastos come about, and what is Elastos?
Actually, the idea was very simple, because I remember the name .NET, because it was popular once, right? 10 years ago, Microsoft, if you look up the internet, actually Microsoft still has the .NET, but which kind of is a failure comparing to iOS and Android. But then anyway, in late 90s, we were thinking to turn the network into a computer, because that's not the idea from Microsoft. That's the idea from the Java authors. In 1992, Sun Micro invented Java programming language. Then the creators of Java programming language, they came up with the term, the network is the computer. Because by 1998, 1999, we at Microsoft actually believe it's time to design an operating system for the network computer, right? Mm-hmm. So it's logically, if network is a computer, as Sun Micro says, if it's true, then it might need an operating system, right? Because a machine needs an OS. That's very logical, whether you understand operating system or not. The basic idea actually is the operating systems we're using today are mostly so-called a device OS, not network OS.
Okay.
The difference is device OS, meaning, you know, you got an iPhone, you got an operating system running on the iPhone called iOS, and you have an Android phone, you know, you got an Android OS running on the Android phone, right? And that's that a device OS is something really take care of itself. And if applications want to go to the internet, actually, the operating system has nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're hijacked on your way out, if you're cheated right? If your data got lost, who do you blame? You blame on yourself. You cannot right. blame on operating systems, right?
Right.
Because the operating system has nothing to do with which website you're going into, where you're going to send, where the developers, where the applications send their network packets. Because people should always remember there are three things happening. You know, there's a user, then there's a machine, and then there's something in between. The something in between is called software. It's called an app. Actually, app is developed by a third-party developer, a team, right? Developing team, correct?
Correct.
That's 101 enough.
Right.
Because the consumer has intention to do something or find information, you know, do banking, playing games. That's what the consumer wants, right? And, of course, they have to trust the software, the developer, for carry out their wish faithfully, you know, have fidelity. Mm-hmm. But then very often the developers won't do exactly what consumers told them to do. Mm-hmm. Because of the developers, the applications could literally give you a free software. But then how are they going to get paid? So they so-called, they collect the big data with or without your acknowledgement. Mm-hmm. Right? They collect data, then they sell your data.
Mm-hmm.
That's the nice ones. You know, the more vicious ones, actually, they simply steal your bank information, simply, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do all those illegal things behind your back. Because so-called Trojan horses, those, you know, heartbleed viruses, whatever, this is all there. It's all the fault of software development. But the device OS, because as I mentioned, in the early 80s, the three things came out around the same time. The network, the OS, and the programming paradigm, they came out around the same time. It's not one after the other, because they're kind of intertwined, mixed, instead of designed in a clear, logical way. That legacy lasted until today. And that's why we see so much network attacks. We see so many privacy leaks. We see so many viruses, right? And that said, consumers are helpless, so they have to resort to big brothers for protection.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you use WeChat, and on WeChat, they have public numbers. Actually, they are micro websites built within WeChat.
Mm-hmm.
So where if you have a URL within WeChat and you click on the URL, you get onto that website,
mm-hmm.
you are protected by WeChat, mm-hmm. right? By Tencent mm-hmm. as a company to guarantee actually the website is genuine. Otherwise, if you go on the internet, you may very likely to encounter some fake websites
right.
or being cheated, right? Everything is the same except the barcode charging you money.
Right.
It's a fake. That said, but of course, you know, there's Big Brother, they seek protection fees, like 30%.
Mm-hmm.
Or they don't let the competitions to get on. Well, you can try to put a URL of Alibaba in WeChat, right?
Right.
To see if you're going anywhere.
Yeah.
Actually, you're not going anywhere, right?
Yeah.
I guess the same thing, you know, in iPhone and you try Android or Android, you try iPhone, you know. It's the same thing. But then the reason why we see cartels more and more is because of the internet turning into a dangerous playground nowadays. Even as early as 20 years ago, back in Microsoft, we realized that's not a fixable problem.
Hmm.
The internet was designed decentralized because anybody with a server can connect to the internet.
Right.
And no IDs, no, everyone's free to get to the internet. But then the good thing is in the 80s, only universities and research institutions are using the internet. And because at that time, everyone's decent and good guys, right? But after 1995, the web basically turned the internet into a consumer phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone uses the internet, of course, including the sharks, the robbery.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the good thing, it's a decentralized, the internet's so popular, and also because of the bad thing of decentralized, no one is in control. That's why the consumers have to seek the protection of
Big Brother.
Cartels.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, the internet is not fixable. The flaws are by design. And people realize that there's not much we can do.
Mm-hmm.
20 years ago, Microsoft decided to do a so-called network OS. Actually, network OS, comparing to device OS, has only one thing in mind, which is to delegate, basically to manage all network traffic applications behalf. Mm-hmm. That said, basically all the network packets, all network protocols are still the same, except one thing. On the sender and the receiver of the network packets is the network OS. No applications, no services, no IoT devices are allowed to send any network packet. That's the key to a network OS. That dream has been going on for 20 years, mm-hmm. as far as I know. And today, actually, the technology is so mature and so ready, but just people don't pay attention anymore. That's kind of sad. But then what I'm saying is that there are still people, right, really, really take it to heart. And if you look at the internet or blockchain, remember the when I 2016, when I learned, oh, there's something new called a blockchain, and I studied what is Bitcoin, what is Ethereum. Mm-hmm. Of course, when I went down to the YouTube and learned about Ethereum, and I ran into a term called world computer. So, because we were doing network computer for 20 some years, mm-hmm. and when I see the word world computer, I was kind of interested and curious. So I did some study, right? What is a world computer? What is a network computer? Basically, the world computer, according to Ethereum, is consists of all the nodes of Ethereum. Mm-hmm. Basically, a ledger is a computer. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, it's a decentralized, or you call it distributed computer, right? Because you got 6,000 nodes, 10,000 nodes, whatnot. Just, you got that many nodes. It's just like your phone got a quad core, a hexa core. You know?
Right, right.
But then, you know, the supercomputers like Cray or other supercomputers consist of hundreds of thousands of computers, right?
Right.
Like Alibaba could compile or put 5,000 off-the-shelf PC motherboards together and create one supercomputer,
right,
to deal with the so-called November 11th quad year,
right,
know, double 11.
Yeah.
Basically, it's a Black Friday of China.
Yes. Right? Where there's billions of dollars of sales in minutes,
right,
and hours.
Right, right. That's the largest campaign of sales every year in the world. That said, they are using those PC boards and to make supercomputers to mm-hmm. Handle the workloads. But that said, Ethereum is one computer specialized in doing ledger. Mm-hmm. Basically, that's a special purpose the computer, which is not even general purpose. So that said, I keep emphasizing that's one computer. Either you call it world computer, you call it one ledger, you know, just one. And I started this journey of blockchain aggregate the world computer with network computer, putting the two in one, right? I started to think about it in May of 2016. Because even today, there are myths. People are thinking, okay, blockchain is decentralized. Actually, blockchain is not decentralized. Blockchain is implemented by using a decentralized computer. Mm. But one computer logically cannot be decentralized.
Mm.
Logically. Right. If one ledger, one accounting book cannot be decentralized, cannot be distributed, one ledger is one ledger. Mm-hmm. It's just like you have one person, you cannot have half a person.
Mm.
You have one computer, you cannot have half a computer. You cannot mm-hmm. have 0.1 computers. Right. But then that's a common sense. But then if you look at almost all blockchain computers, blockchain projects, and people still have that myth. And what needs to be decentralized? Decentralized has to be multi-parties, multi-players, right? On the internet, there's Facebook, there's Google, there's Apple, there's Microsoft, there's Amazon. Who is the bigger brother, mm-hmm. right? Can they trust each other? And how can they negotiate, come to their senses to be so-called decentralized in a more reasonable order, right? So if they don't trust each other, can they trust the blockchain to issue IDs?
Mm-hmm.
Currently, if you are in the Apple ecosystem, or if you are in Facebook ecosystem, or if you're in the Android ecosystem, you know, first thing they do is they give you ID. They give you Apple ID, they give you Android ID, they give you Facebook IDs, right? But then can they agree on one set of IDs agreed upon by all the players? So they can interchange information, like email, right? Because you got Outlook mail, you got Gmail, you got iCloud mail, you got Yahoo mail. People can talk to one another, correct? But then with the social networks, they cannot. They have to use one set of IDs, which is kind of biased. Can we have a neutral set of IDs agreed upon by all big players of the world, of the internet? That's something, because as I said, internet was decentralized, which is a great thing, because everyone could access internet, right? Everyone in the world can access the internet, can exchange information. But then since the bad guys are doing all the viruses and attacks, people now are afraid. So they use internet less. They use the cartels more. Can we return back to the more neutral internet? So first step is we have to have an ID for the internet. The ID could not be controlled by any country, not be controlled by any organizations, right? So as I said, we have done the so-called network OS for 20 years. Now we run into this blockchain. We use this work computer to issue IDs for the internet. There are two different things, right? One is the blockchain issuing IDs for the internet. So they're really mixing the two and not to really expand the capabilities of the blockchain and turn that blockchain into a computer, a general purpose computer. Blockchain is a specialized computer. Good for ledger, okay. But they're not good for computing.
There's been a lot of information here. I had a couple mind blows already, but I still am confused. What is Elastos? But a couple mind blows I had was that ledger isn't decentralized. It is 100% logical. Everybody says decentralized ledger, you can't do that. No. They're just copies of a ledger all over the place. And right. There's no such thing as a decentralized ledger. You can't have half a person. That was a mind blow because I never thought of that. It's so simple.
It's just one ledger with more trust, right? Because, a ledger is a very simple thing. Actually, Bank of America has a ledger for all the check transactions, correct? And just we don't trust Bank of America as much.
Right.
And we should, but then
right.
Just for the arguments.
For arguments, I guess.
So we could trust the Bitcoin ledger more than Bank of America's ledger. That said, it's just the ledger we could trust more because the ledger is not controlled by any organization. The ledger is not controlled by any government, put it this way, right? So now people start to build a faith around this trustworthy ledger. But trustworthy ledger doesn't mean it's decentralized ledger. These are two different things. One ledger can never be decentralized. One computer cannot be chopped into halves, correct? So that said, without this common sense, and we really could not move anywhere because we don't even have a solid foundation to argue, to reason on where are we going. Basically, we're building a skyscraper out of sand. There's no way.
So if you were to sum up Elastos in, let's say, 2 to 3 sentences, what is Elastos?
Elastos, actually, we had a slogan saying Elastos is a smart web powered by blockchain, which is a safer internet powered by blockchain. What I'm saying is we're building a new internet. And with the ledger to manage IDs, to keep track of provenance, and to issue tokens, right? To create scarcity.
I'm sorry, I have to wrap my mind around this because this is honestly this is complex for me. So you have we're talking about this big brother, and I really like the way that you took us down this journey of you have to trust WeChat, big brother, to stop you from the bullies. That's why people join gangs in inner cities. So they have a group of numbers so they don't get picked on walking to school and people steal their lunch money. Well, if you're part of the bigger group, that's not going to happen. Now you just have a big group versus a big group, but they're of course separated. And Microsoft or Skype or all these other places, Facebook, Amazon have their own IDs. Now you're siloed into these two different groups. You're saying that we should be more connected into the internet itself instead of these cartels, these big brothers, with our own internet ID that offers our own protection for the internet. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
And that is what Elastos is trying to do, and it's trying to take the internet back from these big brothers that control the block, that control, say, the streets. This is the hood of this gang, or the hood of that gang, or the hood of this mafia, and allow mm-hmm. everybody to walk down those streets independently.
Safely. Right, and safely. Because people are saying, there's a lot of people talking about Bitcoin being the ledger and Ethereum being the smart contract, and they're talking about the next generation should be dApps. The decentralized apps, that's another way to look at it. So-called decentralized apps, actually apps are the ones the consumers use. Decentralized meaning we get rid of the intermediaries, right? Mm-hmm. Decentralized, no big brothers. And when we start this conversation, I was saying, who is the big brother of today on the internet? And I believe the number one big brother, actually the number one most likely to behave evil is the software, is the application in general. That's why we need dApps.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, because people are saying, talking about your own data, we make this podcast, make a short video, make an ebook, mm-hmm. Whatever created by consumers, right? Then they will be played by media players, correct?
Mm-hmm.
The media player could tell you how many times it's being played, and you get your fair share of your work, right? And podcast, you know, maybe it's a fair and telling you it's played a million times, but definitely there are media players not telling the truth.
Yeah, true.
For so-called secondary piracy, because if you sign up, because you cannot protect your own data, mm-hmm. you have your own podcast, you send through the social networks. Of course, people would freely copycat your work.
Mm-hmm.
That's called first piracy. And of course, you cannot monetize your own work. What you can do, you resort to big brothers and saying, hey, I give it to YouTube, I give it to Facebook, I give it to Apple, right?
Mm-hmm.
And hoping that they give you a fair cut.
Hmm.
And some players, I'm not saying that three, but then definitely there are players not telling you the truth. For example, there are some movie theaters playing movies. Of course, for whatever reason, they play more times than they report. So they don't have to pay that much copyright.
Right, yeah.
That happens. I heard people, I'll name names, but then I've heard stories.
Right.
But then who are the media players, right? Because basically, if you think about it, software in general is... they are all media players. Like if you have a PDF played by Acrobat, if you have a doc played by Word, if you have Excel played by Excel, right? Because the software generates data, the consumer generates data through software. And the software actually is not really consumer. The software is developed by a third party. The third party could do something behind the consumer's back.
Dude, this whole conversation is just a mind blow right now.
Right?
You just told me Acrobat is a media player. Excel is a media player. I have never thought of it that way.
It is. Because if you think that way, and because of, as I said, the network, because the operating system does not provide any protection, the software, the application can send your personal privacy data anywhere they like. So I'm not saying the software developer could be evil, but then the viruses injected into the software could also be the evil part, right? Mm-hmm. Somehow turn the application into zombies. What I'm saying is the biggest evil actually is the software. Without a network OS, without an OS protection, basically we can never get rid of viruses. We can never get rid of the network attacks. But the second most likely evil actually is the server, right? Because the server, on the other hand, also could have virus infected, could have intentionally or unintentionally manipulate the order, manipulate the user data.
Right.
Right? Happens. So the server software, again, because server software is also running on device OS, running on Linux, running on old Windows, right? And can we have them running on a more safer environment so then, you know, the servers cannot send network packets, they cannot breach the user privacy. The third evil, actually, is the carrier. Because if you think about the browser, website, and HTTP, client-server network, right? So the third evil is the carrier, because the carrier, if you want to use your phone, talk to your home camera, actually because you don't have an IP address at home, there's always a carrier behind your back.
Yeah.
No, most of the consumers don't know. You know, if you buy Apple or Android, maybe, you know, they're big enough, they're conscious about securities, right? Mm-hmm. But then if you buy a generic brand, they just want to sell it really cheap, and they're not very security sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, in 2015, December, a lot of video cameras and routers acting as zombies, mm-hmm. and launched DDoS attacks to DYN.com and collapsed half of the United States internet, right? In that day, Facebook was down, Twitter was down, and half of the U.S. was down. And 3 months later, the whole Germany internet got shut down by the same thing. Because if you see how many IoT devices out there now, they can all instantly turn into zombies because of the, remember the old routers have the username admin, password admin. So they just basically put viruses on your PCs and you bring your PC home and the viruses start to acting up within your home domain and searching for 192.0.0.1 gateway and find out admin, whether they can get in, log in to your router.
Mm.
If they could, they'll inject viruses into your router and mm-hmm. waiting for that full moon day, right?
Right. And now a word from our sponsor. MIT Sloan School of Management's Blockchain Technologies online program in collaboration with Get Smarter. The MIT Sloan Blockchain Technologies program takes place over 6 weeks entirely online and focuses on solving existing business problems through the use of blockchain. Participants in the program will learn how to harness blockchain to unlock business opportunities. The next presentation of the online program will take place on August 29th, and MIT is offering my listeners an exclusive $250 discount for the course. Register for the Blockchain Technologies course, and you'll be able to enter our promo code, CRYPTO101, that's CRYPTO101, when making the payment. This $250 discount is limited to the August 29th presentation of the MIT Sloan Blockchain Technologies program only. Once more, you can receive an exclusive $250 discount when you sign up for the August 29th presentation of the MIT Sloan Blockchain Technologies online program using this promo code, CRYPTO101. Now, back to the show. Okay, so I'm gonna try to get this back because I've had too many mind blows today. So there's three evils that you said: the software, the server, the carrier. We've talked about privacy, the idea of the network OS to protect, get the bullies off the street, the gangs off the street, get the individual to be able to walk down the streets freely, safely. That's a key word.
Right.
What is Elastos going to do about that? If I'm the consumer, if I'm the average consumer, and you and your product is implemented properly, everything, how do I interact with it?
Basically, as I said, we're building a new web. Very much, if you think of a web, we need a browser, we need a website, we need a HTTP, correct?
Mm-hmm.
The web. So actually, we're Elastos, first of all, is a web. It's a new web. It's mm-hmm. called a smart web. The web that runs apps, that's why we call it a smart web. The current web is the web of information, the web of data. Because
mm-hmm.
if you have URL, you click on it, you got what? You got a web page, you got a picture, you got a PDF file. So on a social network, on Facebook, you send, you share with your friends. What mm-hmm. are you sharing? You share photos, you share messages, you share files,
mm-hmm.
videos, correct? Actually, you're sharing data.
Mm-hmm.
You're sharing information. Then if you look at Android, they're doing something called instant dApps. And can we share code? Can we share binaries through social networks? Can we, instant apps through the network? Mm-hmm. So that's why it's a web of apps instead of web of information. Why we call it smart web? That's why, because it's a web running apps. When you run apps, you need a execution environment, which is a network OS to quarantine viruses. Because when you run apps, because I send you a executable through email, and most people learn their lessons, not opening up, not clicking,
right?
Because if you click, more likely your computer would be infected.
Right.
And so in order to share apps on the internet, we really have to have a more advanced virtual machine OS to quarantine the viruses. So that's on top of the web, we have to build these virtual machines. Those two things have nothing to do with blockchain. That's what took us so long, right, for the past 20 years, not only me, but also Microsoft and others, right, for that many years to drive very hard to iron out all the wrinkles and make sure everything runs smoothly. Then the third thing, actually, is the blockchain. Mm-hmm. The blockchain gives us two things. One is, as I said, give us the IDs, give us the provenance. Because if you have your podcast, you can prove you are the first author of the podcast.
Right.
Right. That's easy to understand because of that ledger thing. And more importantly, blockchain gave us something else. Because I was mentioning the internet of games, internet of apps. Because that's what we've been doing for 20 years. But basically, not until recently, the technology is maturing and it's almost ready. Actually, it'll be ready. Alpha version will be ready next month, end of next month. So it's we're not that far off.
Well,
and we have a beta by the end of this year. So it's half a year from now.
Mm-hmm.
Blockchain also give us something called, we actually build a set chain, so-called tokens. Basically, it's a scarcity because let's say you have that many Bitcoins, you have 10,000 copies of your podcast circulating on the network. Can you issue 10,000 copies of tokens encapsulated into your podcast and then make your podcast a little game?
Mm.
And, first of all, turn your podcast instead of MP3, MP4, you turn it into an executable.
Mm-hmm.
A little piece that self-propellings running by itself.
Okay.
And it's a little game just by playing itself. Can fast forward, fast rewind, and stop.
Right.
So basically, it's very simple templates, and you scramble your podcast with that game templates and with a public key, private key, and you scramble it into one. I used to call it a digital capsule, and you make 10,000 copies of the digital capsules, and then you inject a token into every one of those, right? So you have 10,000 copies of digital capsules with their unique tokens.
Mm-hmm.
Then you pass them around, circulating on the internet. And every time this capsule is executed, and several things will happen, because every time it's executed, it'll tell you it executed once, executed twice.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to be cheated by the media player because you are the media player yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you turn the podcast into a game, so you're bypassing the media player.
Right.
Otherwise, if you're MPEG 3, you have to be played by the media player. That's the middleman. And the media player is played on the OS.
Right.
Correct? Can we turn that MPEG 3 into a game itself, bypassing the media player, so you're running inside this virtual machine OS directly?
In the capsule.
So that we, right, that's how we get rid of this software or media player, by and large, as middleman.
Hmm.
And of course, every time this media player, every time this podcast being executed, then it give us, give the virtual machine a chance to check against the blockchain. Do you still have the right to play? Let's say you paid $1 for it.
Right.
And after you listen to it, could you sell me for 50 cents?
Hmm.
Sell me a used book, right? A used podcast. And if you sell it to me, you're not able to, you're not going to play it anymore.
Right.
As if you have a book, you sell me the used book.
I can't read it
you
anymore.
You don't own it anymore.
Right.
Right. But then you still have the bit on your machine.
Right.
Correct? Because that's the nature of software, computers. You sell me your podcast you paid a dollar for, and then but you still have the bits on your machine. When you sell it to me, the token transferred to me already and scrambled into this public chain, public key, private key, right? Recorded on the blockchain.
Mm.
And when you play your bits on your machine
right.
once again, right, the virtual machine will have a chance to check. So that's the foundation of this digital economy. When people saying you own your own data, people are saying we are going to create a new economy through blockchain technology, that new the means for us to move right to the new economy actually is turn everything into executables.
Mm-hmm.
Without other route to achieve this goal. So if you look at blockchain projects of the world, how many of them are talking about the new economy? And how many of them talking about you literally have to turn the data into code so then you can have a digital economy? Otherwise, you simply don't.
I think that leads us to the next question, the next logical question. Elastos, 10 years in the future, the new economy, how do you envision it? How do you envision that we're going to be interacting with data, with apps, with the internet that's going to be different than today?
Because actually I wrote an article in a Chinese magazine, a journal, that's a computer journal, 2011, forecasted the new internet will be made of apps instead of made of data. So that'll fundamentally change the way the world works. Because of if you look at it, currently, if you buy a paperback book from Amazon,
mm-hmm.
you can sell it. Basically, you own that book. You
right.
own the personal property, private property of, right, the tangible mm-hmm. item. But then if you buy an ebook from Amazon, can you resell it?
Hmm. You know,
basically,
you can't, can you? I don't know actually the answer.
No. Basically, you leased it for life. Basically, that's why there's only cartels on the internet. There's no private digital assets.
That's amazing.
There's no capitalism on the internet at all.
Hmm.
Right? So it's all cartels and feudal systems. No capitalism. No personal properties on
wow.
the internet today.
So in your future, my ebook that I bought from wherever I bought it from is going to be in this capsule. I'm gonna read my ebook, exploding in this capsule, opening it or whatever you want to call it. It's gonna pop back to my link to my key that knows that it's been opened, it's been read, it's been bought, it's been purchased. I then have this ebook in this capsule still, the executable. I'm going to repackage it. I'm going to sell it to Mr. Chun that's sitting in his house talking to me right now because I said, hey, it's a great book. You should get it. I'm going to sell it
sure.
to you for 10% off. It's going to be
right.
a new capsule. I'm going to send it to you.
Mm-hmm.
What about
right.
the author? Does he still get a piece of that?
Yeah, he could get a pay. He could have got a cut because we do have a so-called metadata. Actually, because every time you resell it, it's repackaged. That's the key word. You get it. Because in the old days on Windows, you know, literally you can copy the software off the hard drive and copy to another PC and run it, right? But on the iPhone, actually, could not. Even if you open up an iPhone and read the files of your flashcard,
mm-hmm.
and you copy those files onto another iPhone, it's not going to run.
Right.
Because of every time you purchase something from Apple App Store, it's packaged uniquely for your eyes only, for your PC only, for your iPhone only.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because every time, because the difference between PC and iPhone is iPhone invented this something called App Store.
Mm-hmm.
So the iPhone, the consumer initiate the purchase action.
Mm-hmm.
Then you log into the App Store and download the app. Actually, the computer is so fast, they package your app on the fly and download it to you for you, your machine only.
How do you think that's a unique copy. How do you think the economy is going to work in the future with this one? For example, you know, if you have a book and it's a used book, and we're using the book example because it's very easy, and it's the first thing I think that I've totally wrapped my mind about is this little capsule, is that if I sell a used book, the reason why it's a used book and the reason why it's less money is because it is used, it's worn. The pages are the book doesn't close properly anymore. It stays open maybe a little bit. The pages are fringed at the end.
Yeah,
so it's a cheaper price. What do you think of the
economy?
Well, if it's a used book, if it's a used paper book, I'm not going to pay the same 100% price for a secondhand copy. If it's a textbook from school, you know, it's used one semester, next semester. But with the capsules, is it still going to be a depreciating asset?
Because it's digital, it's virtual, there's no wear and tear.
Right.
First of all, you're not going to really have the wrinkled corners. And on the other hand, also... if you see literally the artwork, paintings, and the bronzes, or if you go to the Forbidden City of China to see those artworks,
mm-hmm.
the emperors put their seals, right, the right seals on the paintings. If for a famous Chinese painting, you'll see hundreds of those red ink.
Right.
Proof who owned it before.
Right.
Right? Because saying this piece, it's not... the age is a small portion of it. Actually, it's whoever owned this piece of work.
Wow.
Make this artwork more valuable.
So, right? a book from Rong Chun, the founder of Elastos, could be worth more than the book from Matthew Aaron.
Well, we'll talk about Kangxi Emperor or Qianlong Emperor. You know, definitely, if you see the seal of the Chinese Qianlong Emperor, let's see. No matter what the painting is, right? If you just see the seal is genuine,
mm-hmm.
that's worth at least maybe a million RMB in China. That's worth at least a million. Because, that king, famous king, right, has a seal on it.
Right,
and from the Forbidden City, put it this way. And so that is a lot. What I'm saying is when we can circulate peer-to-peer without... intermediaries, actually, but then who the ownership of the author put in a new kind of a smart contract. The smart contract different from the blockchain smart contract, the executables, right? They have description languages and who should get what cut. And that kind of dictation, who is the executor that will, right?
Right. Right.
And the executor actually is the OS opening up and seeing, okay, that's what the authors wish.
Right.
And then we just follow that and say the author wish to have 5% of the cut for every resale. Then mm-hmm. he'll get 5% of the cut. And when people acquiring this piece of work, there's always a notice saying, hey, beware, right? Author will get 5% and so-and-so will get what.
Right.
And you want to agree or you don't.
right. Mind blown. Mr. Chun, do you mind if we go into some general questions about the crypto space?
Sure.
Hey, thank you. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. What do you think of... Actually, I'm going to skip that question. What project, if you were to pick one besides Elastos, and I know that it's a big project... And there's a lot of concepts that people are going to listen to in this episode of Crypto 101 that is going to take some time to think about and really ponder of what is the internet, what is the Internet of Things, security, safety, especially these capsules you're talking about, how everything's going to be apps in the future and not just data. What projects do you think that's going to have the most impact in the future when it comes to tech companies or companies coming out?
Basically, I believe the whole internet will be turned upside down.
Hmm.
The almost everything, because let's say the internet, basically, we're going to release an alpha version by the end of next month.
Mm-hmm.
That said, basically, that's pretty much you can think of a browser without HTTP.
Mm-hmm.
You have a browser, and basically it's a Chrome browser, and we add a wallet into it. We add a peer-to-peer network protocol into it. We add a so-called runtime into it, and we just basically add quite a few of those decentralized peer-to-peer protocols, software stacks into the browser. But and we yank out a very critical one. We take out the network access from the app, right? So basically, if we're going into not really 101, it's a graduate level 101. It's just basically you have only 127.0.0.1 to access. You only have localhost to access for the browser, nowhere else. Basically, you do a localhost slash a hash, then you're going anywhere from there.
Okay.
You basically, you know, just depends on the hash. You could go across the continent. You can go download an ebook. You can play a movie. It's all localhost slash a hash. As simple as that, right? You pretty much you get everything. And that's that. That's equivalent saying you're not going to have direct access to the internet. So then the applications within this digital capsule, you cannot steal consumers' privacy data, because even if you steal it, you have nowhere to send it. Where are you going to send it?
Right.
Because the user, remember, there's a consumer dictates the hash. I'm going to access this website. I'm going to my home camera, right? So that's what the hash is. Of course, we won't let the applications to redirect, to duplicate the packets and send one copy to your home, send another copy to their cloud server.
Right.
That's not going to happen, right? Because they don't have this freedom. They don't have this channel to do that. And that's very, very key to this smart web. And that's why we need this virtual machine to be one key component. The other one is the so-called new internet. We call it a decentralized carrier. Mm-hmm. You can think of it's AT&T, Verizon, but then without AT&T, because it's autonomous running, bootstrapped from blockchain, the IDs, all the phone numbers issued by the blockchain. So no companies behind this carrier. It's running automatically, right? And of course, the third one would have the sidechains to keep track of the scarcity, like 10,000 copies of digital capsules, and or websites controlled by a smart contract, controlled by a small group of nodes based on consensus.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the new internet we're talking about. So we're hoping to have this new browser next month. And we have this new so-called macro websites. So the websites are out of your homes. Like you have a router, put a NAS, put a PC behind your router, and install our software, and you can access from your phone to the website, and without a carrier.
So next month, they'll be able to try out the browser and download it from elastos.org? Is that correct? Perfect.
Yeah, but the end of next month.
Then the next month. We're looking forward to it. We're looking forward to it. I have one last question for this conversation, but before I ask this last question, I want to say, Mr. Chun, thank you very much for not only the history lesson, the educational eye-opening lesson on the internet, the future of the internet, your project, and, well, taking so far an hour and 10 minutes out of your day to talk to me sitting in Taiwan. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you for the time, because I appreciate all the help we can get, because we definitely need the publicity, because this project has been going on for a long time, especially for the last year. But since most of the engineers are based in China right now, we are looking forward to moving the project to the world. So having more people to know what's going on and realize a new tidal wave is coming. So we welcome everyone to join us. And we also set up a website called cyberrepublic.org. And we set up bounty programs, and people could contribute their own ideas. Say, if you want to build an ebook engine, they want to build a some marketing engine or whatever, so they can propose and seeking rewards and join it.
Right on. Well, I think they probably will after listening to this, and I hope that you the great success in the future, and that people do start paying a lot of attention to this project that you've been working on for almost 2 decades, sir.
Yeah.
The last question I want to ask you is, Crypto 101 is positioned itself to be probably the first stop for a lot of people getting into the crypto space. When the Bitcoin price goes up, people start flocking in. They want to start buying and paying attention and learning about blockchain,
sure,
the ecosystem, and what's happening here. Right. What advice would you give that person just getting into the space right now?
I want to emphasize the key word, common sense.
Mm.
Because as I said, a ledger is not decentralized. That's common sense.
Oh, and I don't know if that's kind of common sense.
one ledger, right? One ledger
We
can trust. One ledger we can trust. Blockchain is building one ledger.
Mm-hmm.
World computer is one computer.
Mm-hmm.
And one computer cannot be decentralized. That said, and so many projects bragging about TPS, transaction per second.
Mm-hmm.
What is a transaction per second? You know, 10 years ago, people assemble their PCs. I don't know if people still do. They will get asked how many CPUs are on this motherboard.
Right.
How much memory does it have? What is the capacity of the hard drive? Remember those days? You know, my CPU is 2 gigahertz,
yeah,
and yours 1.3. You know, heck, mine is better than yours. You know, I got quad core, you got single core.
Yeah.
Blah blah. Right. But then, you know, speed. Does speed make a difference? Yes, it does. But to what extent?
Hmm.
I mean, if we're envisioning a future, speed is nothing to do with the future.
Hmm.
Right? Because people never ask about what's the speed of the internet? What is the speed of the operating system? What is the speed of your game? And if people brag about TPS, they're really literally barking on the wrong tree. Because no matter how fast is your computer, I mean, of course, as I said, a supercomputer faster than yours, I mean, to some degree, it's a good thing to do scientific calculations.
Right.
But can I put it in my pocket? Right? One computer definitely is not going to solve all problems.
Mm-hmm.
One computer can never solve all computer problems. That's common sense. And also, the speed of that computer in the history of computer science, that's literally irrelevant. When we talk about the future, right? Then basically, when I see blockchain projects talking about TPS, that's so pathetic.
Well, actually, now that we went down this road, and I want to say that you're very passionate about what you just said here when they're talking about TPS. I'm a sucker for it. I will say that I have looked at companies. Well, okay, let me rephrase this. There's a lot of companies coming out right now that are trying to solve Ethereum's scalability problem. And we've saw that, you know, transactions per second is an issue when you're talking about sending things through the Ethereum network. CryptoKitties was a big choke on the network. So people have said, you know what, we have to solve that problem. And they come out and they say TPS, TPS, TPS. Why is that irrelevant?
Because, as I said, basically, when you run apps, you're running it on the iPhone, you're running on the Android phone, you're running on the internet. You're not running the app on the blockchain. The blockchain actually is centralized. Let's say CryptoKitty. CryptoKitty, right? They have a cloud server somewhere from their company.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have so-called a trustworthy ledger based on blockchain, Ethereum. Basically, that's a trustworthy ledger with a centralized cloud server on your browser. Basically, got three things. They are not really decentralized. What if the cloud server crashed? Are mm-hmm. you still able to run this CryptoKitty, right? You cannot. If the server crashed, you don't have a kitty anymore. So basically, when everyone is using blockchain, the Ethereum blockchain, that's logically a centralized ledger with more trust. That's a star architecture, right? All the browsers going into that ledger.
Mm-hmm.
Is that logical? And that's why people have to use common sense. have to go back to computer 101 instead of blockchain 101. That's what they need.
Follow up to that question. Where would you recommend somebody to go to computer 101? Is there any resources that you recommend for somebody to say, Mr. Chen, you have a great point. I need to know this. Where would they go?
Well, let's see. There's a Moore's Law. There's a Amdahl's Law, right? A grad school 101. Basically, Moore's Law saying, if you have too much work, you offload it to others. You do parallel. So you basically, together, you produce more, more efficient computation. The other one actually is blockchain. We don't trust each other. Then we keep a ledger, we keep a copy, each one of us. Does that gain speed?
Mm-hmm.
That gain trust, reduce the speed.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is gaining speed, right? To work collectively. So they're completely two different things. And trying to make the blockchain more efficient. And then say, if you increase the number of transactions per second, are you going to keep that marked garbage forever? because the Bitcoin, right, the ledger, the provenance, the notary public of the internet, you know, every 10 minutes, you generate 1 megabyte of ledger, right? And 10 years later, you generate about 200 gigabytes of those, because every 10 minutes, it's 1 megabyte, and you can do the calculation.
Mm-hmm.
But then the thing is, if you are 10 times faster, you get 10 times more junk.
Right, yeah.
And you put movie and podcast into it. Are you kidding me?
True. Very good point.
Right? So those are really, really computer 101. I think without those consensus, the blockchains are not going anywhere because they're wasting their time.
We've learned a lot today, and we're going to go to computer 101. We're going to go to blockchain 101, crypto 101. And I think that you brought up a couple of really good points, and you've made me rethink what I am doing with crypto 101 as well. And I think that we do have to go to probably computer 101 and have to start looking for guests to start giving those lessons as well, because we do need to know more about how we access the internet, how we access the apps, and how we, well, computer 101, just like you just said. Sir, thank you very much for your time today. And I think it's probably around 9 o'clock at your time over there. And I hope that you have a great evening. You have a glass of wine, you watch something nice, and you have some time before your long flight tomorrow.
So we'll be on the same time zone tomorrow.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. Exactly. Sir, thank you very much for your time.
All right.
And we'll talk to you soon.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Crypto 101. In our next episode, we have on Lee Jun, CEO and founder of Ontology. And he's going to tell you all about that project. In the meantime, go to YouTube, Crypto 101 with Matthew Aaron, to hear the roundup from this episode. And as always, apogeecrypto.com, that's apogeecrypto.com, the best place for your real-time prices, cryptonews.com for your news, and WP on the fly if you need a website. We'll see you in the next episode of Crypto 101. Apologize for this long one. Hope you made it to the end. Thank you very much.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.